Welcome to another episode of Mentors Collective. Now, one thing that I've struggled with in scaling my business is once we hit 20 employees, you run into different types of problems than when you're just starting off, when it's just yourself and maybe one other person. So as you grow, new problems will arise, problems that you weren't expecting to have, problems with HR, problems with legal. And your life starts to change very quickly. Your responsibilities need to change quickly, and your skills need to adapt to the changing problems and day-to-day. So one of the things that I've found was critical in the growth of my company was learning management and leadership skills for myself. And to do that, one of the best things that I've done and that you can do is to find mentors who have done this before. So in this episode, I'm blessed to have Steve Prieta here. Steve Prieta has built and sold an investment banking firm in Europe. Super impressive, Steve. And now he helps businesses and business owners around the world scale their business and build their ideal life. So Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Jay. I'm excited to be your guest.
Me too. Let's have some fun. I detect a European accent, so let's start there, Steve. Where are you from?
Yeah, so I live in Richmond, Virginia, Central Virginia, which is it's got a conservative past, and I don't know what the future brings, but a lot of conservative people here, and when they hear someone with a foreign accent, they always get suspicious. You know, they ask, "Where are you from?" And I like to tell them that I'm from the far east end of Richmond. And then they look at me and I tell them Budapest, Hungary. So we moved here about 12 years ago from Hungary. And I can't get rid of the accent. If Ed Teller could not get rid of his accent in 50 years, I think I'm going to be challenged to do that in the next 10.
I think it works. And it's got an air of mystery. Like when I hear you talk, I don't quite know where you're from. Certain accents are very distinguished, like British or Australian. I can tell it's European, but I don't think you should ever get rid of it. I think it's awesome. And Budapest is one of my favorite places in the world. So I'm sad to hear that you left, but you started and sold an investment banking firm. That sounds insanely impressive. I would love to hear more about that. How many employees was it? What were you doing? Do you have a background in finance? Give me your backstory, Steve.
Yes, I had a background in finance. I started my working life as a banker and an accountant. I worked for KPMG in London, which is a big accounting firm. And then I joined a bank which was very active in Central Eastern Europe. It was kind of a world bank for Central Eastern Europe. And then I joined another bank, and one thing led to another. And at some point, I left. I actually got pushed out in a reorganization. And I was 35 years old, and I thought, wow, this is the time. I always want to start my own business. I'm 35. That's the right time. I done my ropes in corporate Europe, I guess you can say. And I started my business, and we grew fast, and we grew to be market leaders in about 5 years, between 2002 and 2007. And wow. Then we went through some gyrations after the financial crisis. It really impacted my business. Had to downsize, but then we built it up. And at the peak, we were 15 people, and we closed 6 to 8 transactions a year in Hungary. And eventually, I sold it to a private equity group that wanted to get into investment banking. And then we moved over here, and the rest is history, so to say.
Very cool. How old were you, Steve, when you sold that firm?
I was 45.
45. So you exited. You've got a buckload of cash now. Maybe. What do you think about doing next at that point? You're 45. You've exited. You've got some success under your belt. What was next for you? What did you do? And what was going through your mind?
So actually, the way it worked was we moved over here in 2012, and I sold my business in 2013. So 2012, I wanted to sell my business, but I didn't get the right offer, and then. I stumbled upon a book, Traction, by Gino Wickman, which talks about how to organize your business, how to implement an operating system in your business. And that really helped me make that business, I call it buyable or sellable. And it allowed the business to stand on its own and for me to pull out. And then I managed to sell it a year later. So the first year when we moved over here, I really thought that I would just create a carbon copy of my Hungarian business. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I landed a couple of investment banking clients. I brought one of my best associates over from Hungary. So it's the two of us, and then we hired a few people here. But after a year or so, I realized that it was going to be much more difficult to build an investment bank here, where I had no connections, basically. Right. And it was a much bigger market. I thought Virginia was like Hungary. It's about the same size, but it's obviously it's just big. It's part of a big market. And I decided that, okay, I had my adventure. I sold my business. Let's do something else. And then I got into coaching.
Beautiful. And coming from the European entrepreneurial community to the American business and entrepreneurial community, I'm sure that must have been a shock. What was the biggest difference that you think exists between being an entrepreneur and business owner in Europe versus now doing it in America? What's the difference?
Well, I would say there are two big differences that really struck me. One was the obviously the market is much bigger and the competition is much more intense. So on the one hand, that was kind of a shocking. Up leveling was required in order to be able to compete here with so many more competitors and people and so many more business minded people, informality and so on. The other thing that came with this was the speed of business. So while a typical meeting would take where you would maybe talk to a client and maybe it was an introductory meeting or maybe it was a presentation meeting, it would be about 1 hour in Hungary. If I went to Romania, where we had an office as well, in Bucharest, in the capital of Romania, it would take about 2 hours. If you went into the countryside in Romania, it would take about 3 hours, so the same meeting. Now, when I came over to America, the same meeting in Richmond, Virginia, would take 30 minutes. People didn't take more time than that. You know, no one brought you coffee and water and stuff like that. There was no preamble to the meeting. You just went into it. And when I went to New York to meet some prospects there, it was a 15-minute meeting.
Right.
So that was a really big difference, you know, the speed of business here. And then the third thing was the level of trust that people have in business. It makes doing business so much easier. So I was a non-entity here, basically. No one knew me other than through LinkedIn. They could look me up.
Right.
But essentially, people took the approach that they would assume that what you said was right, who you were, who put yourself forward as was who you were. They gave you the benefit of the doubt, which would not happen in Central Europe. Central Europe people are very, very guarded and very, very suspicious. So that made it so much easier because you could be communicating to people, you could be taken at face value until they found otherwise. And that somehow was very, very refreshing, and it made it to do business much, much easier here.
That's great to hear. And I'm curious about the time difference. You said in Romania, it would be a 3 hour meeting versus a 15-minute meeting in New York. Where do you think that comes from? Do you think people operate at different speeds? Do you think it's brain processing, culture? Why are the meetings, the times so different?
Initially I thought it was all about trust building. So you would need to take more time to build trust before people would actually engage with you on substantive topics. I think that's part of it. The other part of it is the expectation of what you need to achieve. So in New York, people, they want to make, the people who engage with me in these meetings, they probably want to make $500,000, $1 million or more money. So they had to get business done much more effectively and in a shortened time frame to be able to get there. In Romania, maybe the expectation was if you made $50,000 a year or $100,000, you were already very super successful.
Yeah.
So you could take more time to get the same result there. I don't know. That's a theory, but I think it's something to do with expectation of what you wanted to get done in that amount of time. The pressure to get that certain thing done, and also it's the level of trust. So when you need to take time to build trust, to communicate, to read the tea leaf, so to say, so that you even would engage with that person, open up to them, then it takes more time to do business.
Yeah, I agree with you. Meetings is something I actually think a lot about in my own company, and something that's usually a massive stress add. So we have like a monthly thing where we try and get as many meetings off of our calendar as possible. Because you can, it's really easy as a founder, as a C-level executive, to get inundated with all of the different teams and things that are going on in your company, and just have your calendars full of these internal meetings. So I'm wondering, Steve, what do you think the ideal meeting time is for like an internal meeting? I like to cap mine at like 15, 30 minutes tops for really important meetings. But You come from a different place, so I'd love to hear your thoughts on internal meeting times and external meeting times.
Yeah, so I actually teach my clients on how to set up a great, impactful meeting structure.
Perfect. Break it down for me. Let's have the spark notes.
So there are different meetings for different purposes. And Patrick Lencioni talks a lot about this topic in Death by Meeting, his book Death by Meeting. So the different meetings. So the first one, first level, the first thing that you want to achieve in meetings is to create good communication so that people connect the circles, so you know what's happening with your team. And it's great to have a daily stand-up for that purpose. That would take you 5 to 10 minutes. So people just connect and, you know, what happened yesterday that the team needs to know, what's going to happen today that the team needs to know, where are you stuck? You just rapid fire. It's all about communication, making sure you have a touch point in the day. The second level of meeting is what we call the tactical meeting. This is where you want to tackle all the issues and challenges and problems that you encounter. And the weekly tactical meeting, it takes longer. It will take you an hour and a half. And the good way to organize this is to make sure that you spend about 30 to 45 minutes smoking out all those issues that you might have. Make sure that your projects, OKRs or ROCs, are on track, making sure everyone's hitting their numbers. Making sure you smoke out any issues on the team or with customers, and then you build your topic list, and then you just prioritize and work on your topics, and you spend 45 minutes to an hour to work make as many decisions as possible and to take action items on the board for this. So you make a decision, you take action. So that's the weekly tactical. Then the next meeting is the monthly financial meeting. So you want to make sure that you're hitting your numbers. So every month, it's a good practice to bring your team together and look through your financial statements. Are we hitting our revenue numbers? Are we keeping our costs to our budget? Are we hitting our gross profit margins? Are we serving our customers profitably? So spend some time every month making sure that you hit your numbers. Maybe you need to look at some of the ongoing projects, we call them ROCs or OKRs, that they are on track. And if they are not, how do you get back on track? So that's the mostly financial meeting. And then quarterly, it's great to bring the team, your leadership team together and review, okay, have we achieved what we wanted to do? Are we on track to achieving our annual goals? Are we hitting our financials? What are the challenges? What are the changes in the market? What are the opportunities? Let's prioritize and let's decide what are we going to focus on next quarter and what do we have to accomplish to achieve the annual goals. And then the annual meeting is a strategic planning. It's all about learning what you achieved and how you did this year so that you can build a great strategic plan for next year, making sure that you're still aligned with your vision and you are on track to achieving your medium-term, long-term goals. So this is your annual strategic planning meeting, and these are the main meetings. Daily stand-up, weekly tactical, quarterly strategic, and then the annual strategic planning. And then you're in good stead, and you're keeping your business on track. When it comes to external meetings, if it's a introductory meeting, I would not spend more than 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to get a client, maybe a discovery a meeting, that will take you probably an hour or so. If you want to close a deal with your clients, it's a pitch, then it would take you an hour and 90 minutes. That's how I think about external meetings.
Well, it sounds like we don't need any coaching. We do every single thing that you just mentioned. So that's awesome. Except the leadership meeting. We actually do quarterly now. We rent out a room, a big conference room, and we lock ourselves in there for the entire day. It's like 8 to 10 hours. And it's been so productive since we started doing this. I think one thing that people don't realize as their companies are scaling is the distance in communication between all of the different departments and how this can affect the company growing. Mm-hmm. They're like each department kind of grows and operates as its own little sub company. And they're growing and building independently. And if there's not good communication there, or the goals aren't aligned and are different, it's amazing what we don't realize what problems are happening as this is going on without bringing everybody together. But once you do, you're able to hash all this stuff out and move forward. So very, very constructive. Thank you, Steve.
Just one more thought. So a big piece of the meetings is what I call peer accountability. Mm. So when you have a team that you meet with regularly, it helps you hold yourself accountable, and then you hold each other accountable as well. It's very motivating for everyone involved if you've got the right kind of people, because people generally, they like to do well and they like to demonstrate that they are doing what they promised to do, that they are achieving things. So you get together and you review the goals and you can tick off the goals. That's a super satisfying and empowering thing to do with your team.
Yeah, I agree with you. So Steve, one of the scenarios that I see all of the time, and I get asked this all of the time, is entrepreneurs who are building this company, they're making all of this money, but they're still the one in charge of all of the day-to-day operations. They're still servicing all of their clients. Maybe they've got a couple support staff or VAs that help them with some basic stuff, but they really want to get out of the weeds, stop selling all day, stop doing account management all day. Who are the first people that these entrepreneurs should hire? Who are the key decision makers and game changers that they need to think about paying the money and getting on board so that they can get out from the day-to-day work and start growing and start building their business?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I mean, the easy answer is that whatever is the missing piece on your business that you have to fill in for is the best person to hire. But if you are a small startup, maybe you're a singlepreneur, you've got a couple of VAs, that means you already took care of the administrative stuff because your VAs probably take care of that.
Right, you've got the VAs.
You've got the VAs out of the way. So I had actually a guest on my podcast, Management Blueprint Podcast, and he suggested that delivery is the first place to go. So make sure that you already have a product or service. So you just, if it's a service, productize it, standardize it, create a playbook that will teach another person how to deliver that service. And that's the easiest to delegate, the execution. And then the next one, when you delegate the execution, that may be sales or maybe it's lead generation. So appointment setting could be the one to delegate, because again, it's relatively easy to systemize. It's easy to delegate. It's not a high bar for someone to accept an appointment as opposed to, you know, agreeing to work with you and pay money for what you do. So it's something that's easy to automate relatively. So appointment setting and maybe sales one is the next. And then the last one is HR. So actually finding the people that you will keep hiring and making sure that the person really understands your culture and the expectations for the different functions in the business that they are hiring for. So that person is probably going to be the next one. And ultimately, the last one, Steve Jobs said that the most fundamental functions of a business are marketing and innovation. So those are going to be the hardest one, because it's a creative piece. You know, how do you create new products and services? How do you find customers in new ways, interesting ways? How do you articulate what your product or service does for people? That's going to be the hardest to delegate.
Right. That's typically the entrepreneur, right? The one who has to start by learning all the marketing, figuring out how to sell their product, figuring out the offer. I was fortunate enough to have a business partner. I'm the visionary. I do the marketing, the business development, the offers. My partner is the operator. I don't know if you've read the book. Oh, no. What is it?
Rocket Fuel?
Rocket Fuel, yes, about the visionary and the operator in a business, and we are the exact pair that they talk about. So he's the money guy, the spreadsheets, the HR, the legal, and he will clean up behind me and make things work. But I think it's very hard to start and grow a business without a visionary, without someone that understands marketing and offers and sales. But having an operator has been really useful for me too, because I hate numbers, I hate legal, I hate looking at all of the nitty gritty along the way. So having someone that you trust to help you with that definitely helps a lot. So Steve, moving on from that, you talk a lot in your website and in your materials about digging a moat around your business. And you moved to America, you mentioned that the competition is much fiercer here. And I've seen that too. You know, I run a digital agency nationally. I compete against some of the best marketers in the entire world, companies that have been around for a century sometimes. How do you dig a moat? How do you protect your business to survive for the long run and to compete against companies that are much bigger, have been doing it a longer time, have more money to spend on ads and acquiring clients? What do you do to stand out and dig that moat?
Yeah, so this is all about strategy and all about differentiating yourself. Because it, you know, being better than others is kind of a futile thing, because you can keep improving and improving, but if you're not perceived as being different and more unique, uniquely fitting the needs of a certain market segment, then you're just going to be seen as a commodity. And if you're a commodity, however good you are, people are not going to pay top dollars for you. So you're probably too young to remember, but you know, when I grew up, I remember in the 80s and 90s, all these, in the 80s, the Japanese electronics companies like Sony and Senyo and Toshiba and Pioneer and all these guys, they kept innovating, they kept making things smaller and better and better. And the prices just kept dropping and dropping and dropping because the competition was fierce and these companies were not seen as very different. In the 90s, the same thing happened to the car companies. You know, the Korean companies came in, compete with the Japanese, and you know, they put more and more features into the companies and into the cars, and the prices pretty much kept the same in real time. So they were better and better, but not seen as different, and therefore they could not get the competitive and lasting competitive advantage. So the secret is to have unique activities. Michael Porter talks about the unique activities in your business that is actually going to make a difference. So if you think about Chick-fil-A, you know, it's closed on Sunday. It's got the pickle brine sauce. The people say, you know, my pleasure. And they bring you the drink to your table. It's much different from the other fast food restaurants. And as a result, they are three or four times more profitable than McDonald's or the others. So how do you build that? How do you dig that moat? You have to find these unique activities that are going to be differentiating your business in the eyes of the customers. And if you put enough of these unique activities together, then they're going to effectively dig a moat around your business, because it's going to be almost impossible to copy you, because these unique activities would all have to be copied at the same time. And some of them are not going to be visible to the customer and they won't be able to know what to copy. So that's how you dig a moat.
No, I love that answer. And I think these unique activities are much harder for bigger companies to implement. Bigger ships move way slower. There's way more. Say that an order comes from the top, it might take months, even a year, to trickle down to the bottom and get things implemented. You got to add it to the handbook. You got to train all the managers. For a smaller company, for a startup, you can be much more nimble. If I want to make a change in my company, the bigger that we've gotten, now I've got to run it by my entire exec board. We've got to put it in the handbook. We need to have everything change. It's a lot slower. So that's where I think startups can have an advantage now against these bigger companies. You can innovate faster. You can add things that you see happening in the marketplace much faster than these bigger companies can. You don't have all the fixed costs that they do, massive salaries, massive buildings. So there's definitely a way for startups and entrepreneurs out there to outcompete the big guys, but very, very helpful.
Jay, there is one caveat though.
And, please.
You know, I'm much older than you, so maybe I've seen more of that stuff.
I don't deny that you probably have a lot more wisdom than me. Yes.
So here is the thing. Yes, the small companies, the young companies, they are much more nimble. They can make decisions faster. They can move faster. They can get twice as much done. the entrepreneurial energy is going to be much closer to getting things done. So you can get things done much faster. However, unique activities take time to mature, because it's not enough to just do something differently. It has to work better. And what I have seen is that the unique activities typically emerge as a result of a big crisis. So a company is hitting the wall. They can't figure things out. They, you know, they are in an existential crisis, and they are forced to come up with a out-of-the-box solution. And that becomes a unique activity over time that actually will allow them later to build that competitive advantage. So in my business, around 2005, we had a crisis. We were in essentially focused on capital raising. There was a government program that that provided capital injection to companies, and we were really kind of cornered the market. And that was 80% of our business. And suddenly, the rug got pulled out of our under us, and suddenly we had to pivot, and we went into M&A, and then we had a cash flow crunch, and we had to figure out how to actually deliver an M&A engagement much faster than our competitors. We basically had to figure out how to go from 3 months to 4 weeks in terms of producing the deliverables, which was a financial model, an information memorandum, and so on. And when we figured that out, then suddenly our offering became much more attractive, because we could go to market in 4 weeks instead of 3 months. So all those customers, they want to come to us. Plus, they paid us the fee, the upfront preparation fee, in 4 weeks rather than 3 months. So our cash flow got much better. And that became a piece of our unique strategy stack, I call it, that helped us then move forward. And then, of course, there were other pieces as well.
That's a good point, especially the one that good innovation comes from crisis, when your back is against the wall and you have to pivot and figure something out. Because when things are going well and the money's pouring in, people aren't usually like, all right, shit, like we need to come up with something. We need to figure something out. We need to switch it up and do it differently. They don't think that way until things aren't going so well.
That's because a lousy teacher.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when it's your money. So whenever this happens in my business, we have a rut, something bad happens. Now me and my co-founder have a conversation that we go back to. I'm like, this is when we're going to grow. And when the market turns and we come out of this, we're going to be much stronger for it. And that's been true for our company. And I think it's a good lesson for every entrepreneur, because we all have these peaks and valleys in the business journey.
So one interesting thing I have discovered is that the best entrepreneurs are often the people who are willing to put themselves in the most precarious situations, because they use it as a forcing function to push themselves to the wall so that they get forced to come up with this great solution. So many of your listeners probably read Elon Musk's new biography that came out a few weeks ago. And he basically has a technique for that. He calls it surge. So he kind of throws these grenades. He creates these crisis situations that everybody are all hands on deck, and people are working like 20 hours a day, and they have to launch that rocket, or they have to get the production of the Teslas up by 200% in 4 weeks. And these are crazy situations which force people to come up with extraordinary accomplishments.
Right. The old burn the boats. Right. If you get to the place, burn the boats behind you, you've got no way to escape. You just have to figure it out, and there's no other option. Exactly. I think entrepreneurs are very good at that, especially good ones. So Steve, also in your material, you speak a lot about creating the ideal life for the business owner, for the CEO. I'm wondering, in your experience working with lots of business owners over the years, what does that ideal life typically look like, and do they ever actually achieve it?
Oh, that's a great question. So the ideal life thing came from my experience as an investment banker. So I worked with scores of entrepreneurs and helped them sell their business. And often the driving force was they wanted to get rich. They wanted to, you know, be financially independent. They didn't want to work a day in the rest of their lives. Or they had this thing. I had an entrepreneur who was 29 years old when he approached and said, I promised myself to be a millionaire by the age of 30, so I have to sell my company by my birthday. And he set this big success fee if we achieve that. And we actually didn't achieve it. And after his birthday, he realized that he doesn't have to sell this company. He can run for another 10 years. So the point is that many entrepreneurs think that their ideal life is to get rich and then have that money in the bank, and then they have all the time in the world and they can travel. And often that's a fallacy, because running a business is a very meaningful activity. You've got a lot of people that you're helping. You've got your team that you're engaging with, and they basically look to you for leadership, and then you're serving the customers. It's a very fulfilling thing. It can be stressful, but it can be fulfilling. So unless you have a better thing that you can go after, I wouldn't advise you to think about selling your business. But if you have an idea, if your ideal life is not to be that entrepreneur, it's not to run this business, then figure that out and then use your business as a vehicle to get you there. I think it's a super big opportunity for us business owners who have a viable business that we figured out how to make money. It may not be super profitable, but we have a machine and we just have to put this machine in good shape, and then we can get to wherever we want to get to. So if we want to get rich, yeah, we can do that. If we want to travel the world and use the money for that, we can do that. If you want to start a foundation and want to give back, or want to become best-selling author and speaker, and you just want to use your experience and do that. So if you just want a very vibrant social life and you want to be a life of the party and host gatherings, you can use your company to put yourself in a position to be able to do that. But here's the thing. When you fix your company and you make it self-managing and growing and profitable, then you might realize that it's actually quite fun to grow that business and to see it succeed. And you no longer want to chase that rainbow and go after something else and give up your identity of being an entrepreneur and do something else.
Right. I can't even imagine what I would do with my life if I were to sell my business, even if I would get $10 million. I have nothing that I want to do with the $10 million. So that conversation comes up a lot with my co-founder and I too. It's like, do we sell it? We've had a couple offers. But I love going into work every day, building the company. And I don't know what would be next if I were to sell the company and go start building the next thing. It's my baby. And I think a lot of entrepreneurs do become attached to their businesses. Having worked with entrepreneurs, maybe who have sold companies similarly to yourself, do you find that they're typically happier after they sell their business and move on to the next thing, or happier when they're in the process of growing the company? What do you think?
Well, I found them to be very happy when they sell the business. So the day when they sell it, it's very happy.
Right. Dopamine rush right away.
The next few weeks is they have a little bit of a buyer's remorse or seller's remorse in this case. But they are still happy because now they have all the time. They have all that security. They can sleep soundly. That the weight is off their shoulder. But 2 or 3 months in, they realize that it's boring to be on the golf course every day. They realize that, okay, it's nice to have this boat and to go out in the river, but that can be boring as well. I mean, unless you have other people to ride your boat out, it's not that exciting to do all the time. So I have found many of them to not become happier. And I saw many of them that, after their non-compete expired, they went back into business and they started another company, or they used the money to buy another company so that they could get back into the game.
Right.
We sold a business to a retired CEO of a public company who was, 68 years old, and he retired. He had all the money in the bank, but he was bored out of his mind. And when I showed him a small company that was profitable, that he said in his industry that he understood, he got so excited, and he came back in and became the CEO, and we found some money for them. So no, my answer is no. And that's actually one of the regrets I have as a former investment banker. I think if I knew what I know now, I could have helped those people to make their business better so that they might not have had to sell it or make money with it while owning it. Or at least we could have made it much more valuable and helped them sell a more valuable asset.
All right, well, we learned from all these experiences, and I'm sure you've learned a lot and have a lot to give back now. And you are giving back. You've got a podcast. You've got all these books. So tell me, for the listeners who resonated with what you had to say today, Steve, where is the best place to start consuming some of your other content? Tell me a little bit about the books, the podcast. What are you working on?
Okay, so the podcast is called Management Blueprint. And the idea is that I am obsessed with this idea of blueprints, so frameworks. So what are those kind of shortcuts, those concepts that help you understand your business and how to grow it faster? And how do you implement it? So I interview entrepreneurs like you, Jay, and maybe you should come on the podcast as a guest as well.
I'd be happy to. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, so we'll talk about that offline. But basically, my goal is to essentially get that thing that this entrepreneur has discovered, a shortcut that is uniquely theirs, and share that with the audience so that people who are driving the car or watching the video, they have an idea and they can do something in their business. So that's the podcast. The books, I have three books. Depends on where you are. So if you already have a business that you have grown and you're ready to sell it, then I recommend you read Buyable. So how do you make your business buyable? How do you tweak it so that you get the best value for it? I've got about 100 stories as an investment banker. Some of the war stories I lived through with my clients are in there. If you are, if you have a business that already makes money, I call it a viable as opposed to a viable business that you figured out how to make money. Maybe it's not very profitable, but you have at least, 10, 15 people. So it's a real business. Then I recommend Pinnacle, 5 principles that get your business to the top of the mountain. And that will help you. It will show you a way. Let me show it to you. So this is the Pinnacle OS wheel. So that shows you the 5 principles of how to build this business and the 15 practices to build a great business. If you already have that great business, so maybe you implemented an operating system like EOS or Pinnacle OS or Scaling Up or something like that, then Strategy OS is your book, because that will help you dig a moat around your business. It will help you put this unique activities, a strategy stack of unique activities together so that your business can grow, become much more profitable, and competitors won't be able to touch you.
Beautiful. I appreciate you sharing. And guys, I'm going to link Steve Preda's website down in the description here at stevepreda.com. And all of his books and podcasts are listed there. But Steve, thank you so much for joining me today. I had a blast chatting with you, and it sounds like we might be able to run it back on the Steve Preda show.
Absolutely.
Thank you again.
It was awesome. It was great fun. Thanks, Jay, for having me.